Welcome, listeners, to a special edition of the Heretics Hour to remember Michael Collins Piper, who passed away last Saturday, May 30th, in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Today's date is June 4th, 2015. I am your host, Carolyn Yeager. With me today to help me carry out this sad task is Ray Goodwin, known to all of you, who had a long relationship with Mike Piper. Thanks for being here, Ray.
Oh, my pleasure. I appreciate being a part of any kind of memorable tribute to Mike.
Well, right. We're going to do our best here. And I was just going to bring up here, I don't know if you've been following the news. I keep looking for new information about his passing, but I haven't found anything new on the ugly truth on Mark Glenn's site, which is, of course, where Mike was living up there in Idaho. For how long had he been there, Ray, with Mark?
He'd been there a few months, Carolyn. I can't remember exactly when he moved out there, but he'd been up there, I would say, probably a year.
A year? Well,
yeah,
that is a long time. And how do you know about how he was doing there? He had a nice situation in staying in the guest house on their property, which kept him a part of the family, and it looks like from that one picture that Mark posted on his site, which I used on my site, that they were took his meals with them, unless he, for any reason, didn't want to, and, you know, something like that. So he was in good hands and in good company, but he was still struggling.
That's correct. He was quite despondent over losing his job with American Free Press. You know, he could not afford to stay there in D.C., or Tel Aviv West, as I call it, but Mark offered him lodging and to come on out and live there, and Mike took him up on it and left most of his library and possessions and things like that stored in D.C. and went on out to live with the Mark Glenn family in that guest house. And Mike was having trouble getting around, bad leg, and was having to use a wheelchair quite often. And so he was quite despondent, you know. He felt like, he told me, he said, my career's over. I kept telling him, hey, Mike, you're a young fella. You got a lot more to contribute. You've contributed so much already. You got so much talent and wisdom and knowledge stored in that brain of yours. And I want you to keep sharing it with us. And he was just saying, well, no, I'm afraid it's over for me. He was quite despondent.
Well, you know, Ray, he was in pain.
Physically,
his body was giving up and had too many pressures on it or challenges. And I know that he had diabetes, and it had gotten bad and destroyed a lot of the nerves in his feet, and that's why his feet hurt so much and he didn't walk. That's why I think that's why he used a wheelchair. I don't know about the leg.
That's right.
But the leg could be part of that too. So it was not just that, you know, he was in a lot of pain. So when you're facing that, you know. And, you know, he can't really come back. He can't really bring himself back again if his body is not going to respond or cooperate. That happened to him at such a young age, really, but some of it was his own doing and maybe his own negligence. But I was reading some emails from him. I have quite a number of them here to refer to if necessary. And he at one point was saying that he told me that that this happened to him overnight. He woke up, it's like he woke up one morning, he didn't say that, but he said overnight, suddenly, without warning, all of a sudden he could hardly walk. And I found that kind of strange. I don't know how it can be that it would be so sudden. Maybe it just felt sudden to him, but I don't think it could be overnight that he would be fine and then be in such bad shape. But it's possible, because I don't think he tells lies or anything, so.
Well, that's true. You combine that with the fact, his physical side is what we're talking about, and then you combine that with the fact of he felt betrayal there at AFP about his job and the way he was being treated. And so you combine that physical stress and duress with the mental, and you know, Mike was paying so much attention to the mental side, trying to keep his job there and trying to keep them, you know, ask them not to cut his pay and everything. Well, you know, he probably didn't even notice, as hard as that may seem, that his physical side was deteriorating as it was. And then, bang, he wakes up to it one day. He starts thinking about it. Oh, my gosh, you know, I can't hardly get around. My feet, my legs. I had a sister that died of that diabetes at age 30. She was born in 1941, and they found out when she was 5 years old that she had that, and the doctors at John Seeley in Galveston told my folks that she would be lucky to reach her 25th birthday, and because back then they couldn't deal with type 1 diabetes as they can now, and my sister died shortly after her 30th birthday, but she was facing things like possible amputation of a foot, or her sight was going down, her kidneys were starting to fail. And so, you know, I understand with that diabetes, that's the first thing I thought of when Mike told me that his feet and his legs were bothering him. And I felt, you know, this sounds like diabetic to me.
Mm-hmm.
But, and it was very sad. And as we'll get to talking about in a little bit, the even sadder in this whole mess was that all within a week or so of his death, things had turned around for him. And his spirits were lifted. He was feeling better. His attitude had gotten good. And I was so pleased. I was thrilled to death. And being this, apparently a coronary, hit him and took him. But that was such a shame because he had already talked to me about, yeah, you know, he said, I've got enough money now. I can move into this apartment I found, and I've got enough money to cover me for 6 months. And he said, after that, I really have to start scrambling. But that was before he found out that he was granted his Social Security disability.
Yeah, well, why don't you tell that story about that from a little further back? He had been trying to get Social Security disability, and he had been turned down, and that... All these things seemed so negative to him, and he didn't see
That's
much
right.
hope. But
That's right.
But yet you told me that before he didn't even realize that that had come through right before he died.
That's right. And, you know, I, having been through that process myself after two back operations, one in 1985, one in 1995, well, I applied for Social Security disability. Gosh, it took me over 2 years to get it, and they turned me down, and I appealed it, and they turned that down, and I appealed it again, and I got one of those people, I guess you see it advertised on TV, to fight for you, and it didn't cost me an arm and a leg, because I sure didn't have that, so this fellow went with me to the meetings with the Social Security rep, and they finally granted that to me, and that's what Mike was fighting. He had been turned down a time or two. He just about given up, and I told him, you keep on fighting, boy, because that could mean quite a difference to you in your monthly income. And he did. He kept on fighting, and I don't know if Mike was aware right before he died that his disability had been approved or not. You know, if he knew that before he died, it wasn't very long because it hadn't been that long, you know, that they granted it to him. But that's why the last time I talked to him was probably, see, he died on Saturday. I talked to him about the previous Sunday, maybe 6 or 7 days before that.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference in his voice was wonderful to hear.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and he wasn't dwelling on the negative. He talked about his personal library and the problems, what he's going to have to do with that and how he was, you know, going to have to get rid of it and all, and it wasn't in a maudlin sense. It was like, this is just one of the things, unfortunately, a person's going to have to do if you can't find somebody that wants them, my books and all. And he was talking about finding that apartment, and he'd be starting to move his things in there, what things he still had out at Mark Glenn's and a few there at his motel. And he was pleased that he had found a place and that he was going to be able to live there alone, and things were looking up for him, and he said that he had heard from several friends and people who had read his books and everything, and they had responded to this letter he sent them. Well, he sent it out to a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
You know, about his predicament
mm-hmm.
and asking for some help, and he got some donations, and even Mark Glenn said, I'm so proud for Mike because he's heard from a lot of people, and some of them have been generous, and it's enabled him to look for a place that he could afford. And that's the sadness of it all, that the heart attack took him, because everything was turning to the positive.
Yeah, well, I think, though, that makes me happy. that he was feeling better. Sure. You know, I'm glad that he was, even if he did, maybe, you know, his time was set in a sense, and at least he had some period of upbeat and he wasn't in some deep, dark hole.
That's exactly right.
At the end. So that's really good news. I didn't realize that, Ray, and I'm happy to hear that. But I think it was the way I understood it from what you said yesterday, that Mark Glenn said that the Social Security had come through, but that
that's
Mike
right.
didn't know that, wasn't informed of that yet.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if
you're not sure. Yeah,
Mike had been informed or not, but I didn't think he had. You know, from the way that Mark stated it, but he may have been informed, and I hope he was really.
Well, yeah, it wasn't like he was like saying, well, I give up, hell with it all, and goodbye. No, he was actually looking forward, but he was
exactly.
still fighting it. He was still trying to do everything that he could do.
That's
he was
true.
Seeing hope, so that is really good news.
Oh yeah, you know, what anybody needs in their life, this go back to a quote that I heard in the, I guess it was the late 1950s, an interview, and they showed it on television, an interview of Elvis Presley, who was 23 at the time. And this interviewer was saying, well, Elvis, you got world by the tail. You got all these gals crazy about you. You got this, that, and the other. He said, are you happy? And Elvis said, well, I guess that depends on your definition of happiness. And the interviewer said, yeah, I guess so. He said, well, Elvis, what is your definition of happiness? And his words for a 23-year-old kid at the time always stuck with me. Elvis responded, happiness is having something to look forward to.
Oh, and gosh, that's right. That is pretty wise, isn't it?
Yes, that's it. Because, you know, it's when you're despondent, you have nothing to look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
You feel like, well, there's no reason to hang around this joint.
Mm-hmm.
And when Mike got that new something to look forward to, it was something different for him because, believe me, my conversations and emails with him for maybe 3 months before this were that he said, the only reason I'm hanging around here, Ray, is my companion, his old kitty cat, Donald, who was 18 years old. And he said, Donald's been my buddy for so long. And he said, I don't want to leave him alone and all. And he said, it keeps me going. Realizing that I need to take care of my cat.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing he did, he asked Mark Glenn, he said, hey, Mark, if anything happens to me, would you promise me to take care of Donald? And Mark said, absolutely, sure will. You know, that gave Mike a little reassurance. But as I say, those conversations a month, two, three before Mike passed on were usually always of a negative I have no reason to go on nature. And I would tell him, you know, that, hey, Mike, tomorrow something may turn around for you. Next week somebody may call you and say, hey, come on over to so-and-so country and give a speech. We'll pay your way, all this stuff. I said, you got a lot of people out there that...
Yeah, but he knew if he had... He knew how difficult that
yeah.
would be. You know, you can say those things, but if he can hardly walk, mm-hmm. he had a lot of pain in his feet. He
yeah.
said it was so painful. It was painful just to walk. And so he didn't walk, you know, and getting
yeah,
around places. But anyway, this is good. Speaking about his despondency, I think we really have to talk a little bit about what happened at American Free Press and why he was so, well, there was two things. Yeah, he lost his job, and it's kind of shocking to all of us that he would actually could lose his job there, that they would,
right.
that they would fire him or let him go or whatever happened. Somebody who'd been a part of that for so long. And then the other thing was his poor health
yeah.
problems. And
that's right.
So when people are, you might say disabled like that, sometimes other people don't want them around, particularly if they're paying them or whatever. They just don't, you know, well, we don't need this guy anymore, but it seems so cold. So, you know, I don't want to attack those people and I certainly don't want to attack the Cartos, but he had started attacking them in, I got some things. I didn't get the last things. He didn't send me those last things he sent out. But, a year ago, we were emailing about something. He was angry with me. We were going back and forth. It's pretty interesting because it just shows the kind of guy he is. And he's always ready to forgive and go forward, you know, with something. But he was angry at Willis's wife, Elizabeth.
That's right. That's
and he
exactly
expressed
right.
a lot of things at that time. And then I guess it just got worse as time went on.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you know about that, Ray?
Well, just what Mike shared with me, and I don't feel it's out of place to say things about this now because, hey, it's true, and Mike is gone, and it doesn't serve to try to attack or damage somebody. But the reason Mike started having problems at AFP was because of Willie Scarto's wife, Elizabeth. And Mike told me some of the things that she would do. She was trying to run the whole show up there. And he said that Willis, in all honesty, due to his age, was starting to get a little bit forgetful about things, and that the more he became that way, the more dominant Elizabeth became, and mm-hmm. tell him how to run the American Free Press. And Mike said that she went into him one day and said, "We don't need Piper anymore. You know, his salary is such. We can save money by getting rid of Mike." And Willis's reaction was to not really accede to her demands, but he had to placate her some way. So he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, we'll cut his salary in half and have him come in less time and things like this." And Willis went to Mike with that, and of course it was crushing for Mike, and they cut his salary, they cut his time. And he said, "It reached the point where I really couldn't survive." And he said, "I tried to fight for it and talked to Willis and things like this." And Mike had devoted so many years of service to the Cartos, and mm-hmm. his book writing and things like this brought them a tremendous increase in readership. And he just kind of felt a sense of betrayal. And as I said, he told me, you know, he said, "Ray, Willis has his faults and everything, but he said, I'm not blaming him for this at his advanced age and all, and he's losing a little bit of his mental sharpness. Mm-hmm. But he said, Elizabeth, he didn't have any kind words for her and her behavior. And so that put him in a real tailspin, and then he realized he had to start looking for another way to survive. And that's how he wound up out there with Mark Glenn, because his health would not allow him to take another job, his limitations and getting mm-hmm, around. Mm-hmm. And he applied for his Social Security disability back then at that time. They would turn him down, and he was fighting for it then. He needed that monthly increase to survive. Mm-hmm. And that kind of put him in his tailspin. He felt like, "Wow, you know, I just can't do anything. I'm not any good to anybody anymore." And so he took Donald, and when Mark offered his place to him out there, he felt like he had no other option, but he was happy to have that one, of course, because Mark's such a good friend and got a wonderful family. And so he moved out there to Northern
Ireland. And not only that, but as I understand it, Mark and another fellow drove from Idaho, Northern Idaho, I think it's Northern, isn't it?
Yeah, very much.
To Washington, D.C., and hauled all kinds of stuff of Mike's, along with Mike and his cat back to Idaho. It took a long time, and it was a big job. So he's been a fantastic friend. I can't imagine a more fantastic friend than Mark
That's
Glenn.
Right.
And of course they had been friends for so long.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, I see Mark, that's a real Christian, you know. There are a lot of Christians who are really, really take their Christianity seriously.
They walk and, the walk
yeah.
and talk. Talk.
They do. They do. They do things that a lot of people wouldn't do, you know, saying, "Well, that's too much for me. Find some help somewhere else," or something. But
that's right. And Mark was in the same position as I regarding how we came to know Mike and owing so much to him for allowing our voices to be heard and encouraging us to, you know, to write things and speak and everything like this. And he helped Mark Glenn get his start.
Sure. Yes, that's right.
It's all good. And for me, he felt like that I had a lot of things that would be beneficial for people to hear. He kept encouraging me send in an article to Barnes Review. Would you consider being a guest speaker at such a place and all? And he was so encouraging. And it came at a time in my life that it was extremely beneficial to me. So I go back to I first met Mike Piper in 2005, but I had conversed with him before that for, I don't know how many years, 3 or 4 or 5 years, whatever. But
when was it that you first, tell that story now, you know, how did you first come in contact with Mike and what happened?
Okay. okay, as a subscriber to American Free Press, I would read it diligently every week, and they started advertising this book about the JFK assassination. And I had devoted many, many years of study and research into that, took a trip to Dallas, walked over the whole area, and read various books about the assassination. And I was always looking for something of a scholarly nature or that I felt may offer a little more information. And they started advertising Mike's book, Final Judgment, you know, by Michael Collins Piper. And it says, the subtitle was The Missing Link in the JFK Assassination. And all along in my mind, I felt that the missing link had to be those who controlled our media. And I knew who that was. And so I felt like there was a definite Mossad or Israeli connection to the assassination, Jewish connection. So I ordered Mike's book. It was a very, very documented book, sometimes to the point of being tedious, but he had to do that so that somebody couldn't say, well, you just pulled this out of a hat. You just made this up. Mm-hmm. But Mike would always cite his sources, diligently footnoting. And I read that book, and I was blown away because it was exactly what had been in my mind for all those years. So I wrote a letter to Mike at AFP, and I congratulated him on a wonderful work. And I told him that I was teaching American history at our local college and that I devoted one class session to that assassination. And I told him that I was using his book as the definitive truth source about the murder of JFK. I would take 7 or 8 books in there, and Mike's would always be the last one I talked to him about, and I told him, this is the very best one. If y'all want an idea about or a more complete picture of the murder of John Kennedy, it's Mike Piper's book. Well, that really blew Mike away. You know, in a speech he gave out in Arizona, he said, hey, there's this history professor over in Texas, and he uses my book in his class as the definitive source. And he was proud of that, and I was overwhelmed that, you know, that meant so much to him. So that's how Mike and I then started communicating. And when I got the computer and all that stuff, and then we started emailing, and he started telling me, Ray, you need to write an article for Barnes Review.
Yeah, but what about the books he sent you and how they got stole from the library?
Yes. That. When I told Mike, how pleased I was with the book, and I was using it in my classes, well, one evening, I had an evening class when I taught this, and one or two of my students said, hey, Mr. Gubin, where can I get this book? Do we have it here in our college library? And I said, no, I don't think it's over there, but I said, I'll tell you what, I will make sure it gets put in over there. And, oh, they were pleased because they did want to read it. So I sent a message to Mike. I said, Mike, would you send me a book for our local Victoria College library? I want to register it and have it available on shelf for the students there. And I mean, immediately, as quick as he could get them here, Mike sent me 3 books, 3 copies of Final Judgment. They were the new 6th edition, the biggest and best so far. And he had written a note in one of them to me, best wishes, Ray, and all this stuff. And so I took one of them to the library, and as a member of the faculty or the adjunct faculty, well, you know, all I had to do was show my credentials, and I said, I want to register this book and get it on the shelves for students. And the librarian said, sure, we'll take care of that. So I left out of there, and the next time my class met, I told my students that the book was available in the library. And a week later, when we met again, 2 of my students said, hey, I went by to check out that book. They had written down Mike's name and the name of the book, and they said they couldn't find it, and it was unavailable. So I went over to the library, and I asked about it. Where is it? Well, we don't know. We can't find it. So I went home, and I got another copy of it, and I took it up there. And I said, look, I said, register this again, please. Put it on the shelves, because there are students here that want to read it. Okay. Well, the very next week, the same students, no, sir, they don't have it. So I go over there again, and, we don't know what happened to it. It's gone. And so that just, all that did was affirm what I already knew was going on college campuses everywhere, and that was denying people to read things that the chosen don't want you to read. And, you know, so that was an experience for me that filled me with anger and all of the resentment at the way they give this, academic freedom and a free flow of ideas. Yeah, but only if it has the Kosher stamp of approval.
Did you tell Mike that his books were removed?
Yes.
Yeah, I bet that made him mad. See, things like that, you get enough of that, it builds up. You have a real case against these perpetrators.
Well, yeah. See, Mike, at about that time, that's when students at either University of Arizona or Arizona State, history majors and all, had a club there, and they wanted to feature speakers on the JFK murder, and there were like four authors that they wanted to invite to lecture about their books and their conclusions on the assassination. And Mike was one of them, and he was thrilled. He told me, he said, I'm going out to Arizona and give a talk. And when that club, and I think it was Arizona State, that published their flyer, hey, you know, attend at lecture hall such a night. We're going to have speakers on the JFK murder, and they listed them. And, of course, Mike's name was on there. Well, that's when the local Jew boys went into action and went to Arizona State's president and told him, you can't have that guy here. He's anti-Semitic. He's a Jew hater. He's a racist and all this stuff. And so the president naturally and the board, as they do, knuckled under to the Jewish influence and said, they told that history club, you can't do this, you know, on university property. And students fought it. They were mad. They said, you know, where is this stuff about free flow of ideas and hearing what people have to say, even if you don't agree with them? Well, we can't have that here on the campus. So those enterprising students said, well, you know, they sent letters to everybody, the authors, and telling them that we're sorry, but the university officials won't let us do this. And these authors had already arranged for their flights out there and everything. Anyway, one enterprising student says, hey, they said we can't have it on campus, but why don't we try to find a hall somewhere here that we can have it? And they wound up getting a hall of some sort. I don't know if it was a VFW or American Legion, some kind of hall. Mike was pleased with that. He went on out there. The audience was reduced, and if it was going to be mostly Arizona State students. But anyway, there was a big enough audience. Mike went out there and gave his talk anyway.
Mm-hmm. Good for him.
And to those... But, you know, that was the example that he used to me. He said, Ray, this is the same kind of intimidation and mind control that these people exercise everywhere. They try to shut him down and stop him, but he went out there and gave his talk anyway.
Yeah, well, you know, he did everything he could to promote that book. He knew that was his major achievement.
That's exactly right.
And he really worked hard all the way through to push his book. And it's terrible when you get so much power pushing back and trying to deny the work that you've done there, the work that he did. Well, tell us about the book that he dedicated to you and how that came about.
Yeah, this, you know, Mike has written several books, and a lot of them deal with the power of the chosen around the world and the influence that they exert. And Mike wrote this book called The Caiaphas Complex, referring to the Jewish high priest, biblical times. Underneath the title of the book, on the cover, it says, An Unsettling, Unexpurgated Exploration of the Dark Side of the Power Structure that Misrules America and Our World Today. And he sent me maybe three copies of it, and I thought, well, that's a good deal. You know, I'll read this as soon as I can get to it. Then I opened this book up, and, you know, right after his title page, and the book is... First U.S. printing May of 2012, so that'll give you an idea. That's when I got it. And, I mean, right on the backside of his title page, there's a picture of me when I was giving my talk at the No More War for Israel conference. And he has the really, really honoring words to me beneath that picture. You know, he says, more voices like this one are needed. And then he goes into description of me and, just really wonderful words, and he dedicated the book to me. Even a page or two later, he made reference to me again in this little short paragraph. He says, Ray Goodwin of Texas, whose visage accompanies this dedication, is one such individual who has risked much by speaking out, and he is one individual whom I admire immensely. So I have singled him out in these pages, but there are, thank God, others out there like Ray, and they're too numerous to mention, but Ray is definitely one of those people whose important individual efforts really count. And, you know, so I was blown away by
that. I bet. And you didn't know until you received the book.
No, that's right. Uh-huh. Okay. I didn't know it. Mm-hmm. And,
I bet it was a shock.
I called him to thank him. I said, Mike, I was blown away by that. And he said, well, you shouldn't be. He said, you know, you're truly deserving of this. And so, you know, that was just another one of the things about Mike. And he got me two speaking engagements, one of them in Washington, D.C., and the other one out in Los Angeles, and gave me an opportunity to meet Frederick Tobin. Actually, in Washington, D.C. is where I also met Mark Glenn, because he was one of the speakers there. But it opened a lot of doors for me. Eustace Mullins, I met Mr. Mullins in D.C., and out in California, I also met Phil Turney, one of the survivors mm-hmm. of the attack on the USS Liberty. In fact, Phil's speech of all of us out there brought the house down. I mean, it was wonderful. He told us about the attack and what he was doing on the USS Liberty and during the attack. Mm-hmm. And we were all fascinated by this, but a lot of people had never even heard of that attack on the Liberty, but Phil did a wonderful job. So, you know, those things Mike Piper did for me, he enabled me. I would have never been giving a talk in Washington, D.C. on academic bias. I would never have been given a talk in California, Orange County, on the manipulation of the media and how words are used to deceive people. And I would never have experienced any of that had it not been for Mike Piper. And
Mike was really good at promoting people that he thought were deserving.
You're right.
He did quite a bit for me. He would have done more if I was willing to go places and do things. But he was always willing to go places and do things.
He
went, you know, all around the world, and I don't think he turned too many invitations down. So
that's
he,
right.
You know, met Ahmadinejad in Iran, mm-hmm. and he met, I can't think of his name right now, but
Indonesia.
Yeah, and other places. So, some of his books, how many of his books have you read? I read a few of them, that's all.
Four, five, maybe, maybe six. But every time he would come out with one, I would get it and read it.
Mm-hmm. I say in this, when I did an interview with him in January 2011, I say that he has written 10 books. Final mm-hmm. Judgment and 9 other books, but then mm-hmm. he had some more after that. So mm-hmm. that's a lot of books, and so he always called himself a hack writer. That he, you know, but he could he could churn them out. That's for sure. He had a good system. I finally figured out from things he said that he dictated for the most part. He dictated into a microphone what he wanted to say, his thoughts, and so on, and then. I don't think he transcribed it. I think he had somebody transcribe them. And then he worked from mm-hmm. that. And I thought that was pretty smart. You know, I should do that.
Yeah.
Start dictating things. And one of the books I read was The New Babylon when mm-hmm. he came out with it. And, that was an important book, I think, because it was a kind of a update on the New Jerusalem, which
right.
was a big book of his. But it was I don't know. I didn't read The New Jerusalem, but I figured it was pretty much the same kind of an idea, but now he called it Babylon. He may have had a little bit different, he had probably some different thoughts about it, but the New Babylon, I thought was quite brilliant because that was the New World Order that we're living in the West is really like Babylon in the old days, place of excess and wastefulness and so on.
Well, you know, you mentioning that, Carolyn, I just happened to look up here. I don't have a lot of my books upstairs here. Most of them are in storage and down below in my garage, but here's The New Babylon. Mike had written in it, best wishes to Ray Goodwin, an articulate voice of sanity in an insane world, mm-hmm. and Michael's MCP, November 29th, 1909. Yeah, and this book
2009.
I'm sorry, yeah, 2009, first printing June of 2009.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that one is definitely one that I've read, is on my shelf, and
And the Judas Ghost was a big seller of his. And then the High Priest of War, I remember that one. I took it with me when I traveled to back home. And I remember my nephew was reading it. I had it sitting around there. But that was a good one, the High Priest of War. So was the Judas Ghost. And then some others I'm looking at here are the Best Witness about Mel Mermelstein affair. Now, I haven't read that, but I would like to. I think that I didn't even know he wrote that until, you know, I forget some of these things, but I didn't know about that one. But I think that Mel Mermelstein case is a very interesting thing. But he must be writing about it from the point of view of the Carto.
That's right. You're right, because I remember that when he wrote that, and how he really took apart that typical phony Holocaust survivor and took him to
jail. Well, the story of what Mel Mermelstein says is what's really interesting to me. But this must be the lawsuit and so on. That, unfortunately, Carto lost. Some of these emails that I was looking at from July 2013, he was more than chiding. He was complaining that he had heard me use the term the Carto industry. And what is this with the Carto industry? And I'm saying, so now I was just going to say, what do you call it? What should you call the Carto empire? I don't know, but there is such a thing, you know, that he oversees a lot and is responsible for a lot and has done so much. He's quite the admirable man, Willis Carto. But I think the whole thing is that he has memory problems, and I'm getting memory problems, so I know how bad that is, you know, and he's got them worse, so that's the problem. And somebody has to take over, and so unfortunately it's Elizabeth doing it. Well, another book is The Golem, which was a pretty big one.
I read that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I read that one. I've read it.
Yeah. Then he had that spoof that he wrote, My First Days in the White House, which was, he was pretending like he became president and what he was going to do. And then he wrote about Traficant, too. He was a big booster of Traficant, and it was called Target, : Traficant. And that's only some of them, because he's got more. He's got more than that. Well, he was a very prolific writer. He was he worked all the time. Of course, as we know, he wasn't married and he didn't have a family, so his family was really the Carto group and what he did there and,
that's right.
And his, all of his work. And he was so popular. He has such a following. But what I notice, Ray, is that, I don't notice, I'm looking for information. I'm looking for notices about him, and they're very slow in coming on the internet. I've seen a few. They're just picking up, say, what Michael Hoffman published, which was a little bit of a very short obituary type thing. But there's still no further information coming.
Right.
And I was just wondering if, I imagine that eventually there will be a memorial service, a very nice one, I hope, possibly in Washington, D.C., from all his associates there. I would think so, wouldn't you?
Sure. I mean, it's only fitting that be done.
Yeah. But they must be a little bit embarrassed right now, because in this situation, that the fact of that they kind of cut him adrift, although he wasn't actually cut adrift, you're saying. His salary was cut in half. He couldn't survive on that. And I don't know if he was still getting something from them all the way, even when he went out to Idaho.
Well, you know, in addition, they cut his salary in half, and then only a short time after that, they told him that they were going to start paying him per article instead of a salary.
And
that was even worse for him.
Too. Oh, yeah. Because you're not guaranteed of anything.
No. And then, limiting the number of articles that he could submit to AFP. And
who told him these things? Who was it that informed him of this?
He was told that at the paper by Willis, but that was through, I mean, Elizabeth's doings, and he knew that. He didn't blame Willis, but anyway, it was just turning the screw. It was forcing him out. You know, cut his salary in half, then tell him he's no longer on salary, but they'd pay him by the submission of articles, and then that his articles were going to be limited to such and such a length or number of contributions.
Well, you know, one of the reasons. I'll just say, just to give the other side a little bit of benefit here and not be so hard on him, mm-hmm. is that Mike did get his health problems at a young age. So although he had he'd been there since he was in his 20s, so he certainly had put in a long period of time. So it's almost like, well, he started young and he was worn out, you know, younger than most people are, but he still had put in a full career. So, but they didn't want to be, I think they didn't want to be burdened with him like a retainer or something to look after him. And he was too young for Social Security. I guess he was on, he had been paying into that. So therefore, he had that coming. But, so it's kind of a, well, he's an example of doing what he thought was right and what he wanted to do for truth and justice. And he paid the price for it. I mean, he didn't have any security. He thought he had some security, I think, with
AFP.
Yeah,
yes, right.
But he turned out he didn't. Well, I first became aware of Mike not until 2005. So you say when was it that you first?
Yeah, it was 1994, and I know I didn't buy it immediately, but yeah, first published January 1994, and. So I read it shortly after that, and that's when I wrote the letter to Mike, how much I appreciated his work, and that kind of began things for us. But I didn't have a computer or anything at that time, and so everything was done by Pony Express, so to speak. Exchanges between Mike and me started at that time, around 1995. So
yeah, well, you really go back, Ray, and you told me I asked you. When you actually woke up to all this, and you said in the 1960s.
That's correct. Yeah, I was about 20.
A lot of people listening and people involved now were born in the, well, even Mike Piper was born in 1960. Amazing.
That's right.
So, you were already, tell us that real quickly. You were listening to what?
Well, I always, the thing that I call the defining moment in my life as a patriot or as an American citizen was not just the murder of John Kennedy, which happened when I was 20, mm-hmm. but the cover-up and the obstruction thrown out by mm-hmm. the politicians and the American media as to dig into it and telling us what really happened and who was behind it. Well, that turned me from a flag-waving patriot, because my brother had just joined the Marine Corps and been shipped over to Vietnam. It turned me from that to one full of skepticism about anything the U.S. government said. So anytime I could get some, what they called at that time, underground literature or articles talking about what was really going on, well, I'd grab them, you know, and read them. And I saw an ad for this book called Which Way Western Man by William Gailey Simpson. And I ordered that book, and it was lengthy, but what a fantastic read. And that book helped open my eyes to the real powers behind the throne, or the ones who really pull the strings, the puppeteers themselves. And so that opened my eyes to a lot of what was really going on, and it just grew from that point.
And then there was Watergate a little bit later on. Yeah, that's right,
74.
Didn't make me wake up like I'm, you know, like I woke up later.
Yeah, but in between Watergate and the JFK murder came the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty and the cover up for that, June the 7th, 1968. So yes, it made me very jaded, very skeptical.
Yeah, well, that's it. That's how this kind of worked its way up, I guess. See, it was kind of interesting that someone named Bob Hardwidge has contacted me on a few occasions, but he wrote to me just maybe a week before Mike died, or maybe 2 weeks, but in between there he was talking about Michael Collins Piper, and he wrote some nice things. But this, I think, is a follow-up email that he sent to me, and I want to read a part of it, because he's the one who says he woke up in 1976, and that was what made me think, boy, that really goes back. And then you said you went back to 1960s. Yeah. This was on May 26th. I really enjoy listening to both you and MCP. I would not have found you, but for the mention MCP made of your website and book a few years ago on one of his broadcasts. That's my little book, my little booklet. He says, I got the feeling that you two had parted ways over the past few years. That is too bad, because I feel you complement one another. You delve deep into historical facts and racial ideas, while MCP covers the current political situations. Then he said, while MCP was taking his hiatus from broadcasting, I was listening to some of his shows that I had archived from 2006. I was pleasantly surprised to hear a caller, Carolyn from Texas. You were wondering why people referred to 911 instead of 911. Interesting call. So that would have, yeah, I was trying to date, you know, when I was calling into Mike's show. And, you know, and I did a few guest spots on his show finally. And that's really what started me thinking that I would like to do radio. So Mike played a role in there. But anyway, I remember that when I called in, it might have been one of the first times, because Mike had gotten into the habit, you might remember, Ray, of saying 911. And a few people had done that, and he picked that up. And so 911 was a big topic at that time. And he said 911. And I thought to myself that 911 was a bad way to say it, because 911 is that emergency number that you call when there's a catastrophe. And what we're trying to show is that 9/11 was not a real catastrophe. You know, it was a fake false flag thing. If you call it 911, then you're kind of giving the idea that this was a real catastrophe and emergency, you know, going on that needs attention and so on. So
right.
I was making that point, and I remember Mike said, well, you might have a point there. And while he was talking to me, he said 9/11. And then after that, he went back to 911. So that's how much influence you have when you try to change people. Anyway, this guy says, and I'll just read this to kind of compare it to you. He says, anyway, I woke up in 1976. I've seen a lot of people come and go. I have let a lot of people go from my listening and reading list, such as Alex Jones, Rince, Jim Morris. These people do serve a purpose, though. A few of their followers will dig a little deeper and begin to see the light. I started out reading my dad's copies of National Review back in the 70s, then Human Events, then the John Birch Society magazine. That took me to a John Birch Society bookstore. The two old ladies running the store talked me into volunteering there one day a week. They not only ordered books from JBS, but also from Liberty Bell Publishing, who reprinted The International Jew and sold such titles as Mein Kampf, Imperium, The Dispossessed Majority, Hoax of the 20th Century, etc. Once I got reading books like that, I was hooked. This man is a real nice fellow, and he has also was a real follower of Mike's, and he got all those last emails that Mike sent out, which I didn't get. They were asking for help and so on, and also making some real big complaints. But after the news of Mike passing came, he wrote me another email and just said, and now he's for the ages. And then I wrote back to him and I said, gee, you know, you have such an interesting life. I'm going to be doing a radio program. I said, this was just the other day, with Ray Goodwin. It would be nice if maybe you could come on for a little while and talk. But then he wrote, he didn't want to do that. He said, I did not know Mike personally any more than I know you. He said, I received a nice note and complimentary book a few years ago. Anyway, he felt it a lot. And he said, he had made copies of a lot of Mike's radio program for himself, and then he was listening to them when Mike was not broadcasting for a while. So I a lot of people did that. A lot of people made copies of Mike's radio programs, which is a nice thing to do, and they would all have that now in case anything happened to them. But he ended what he said. He said, I pray that Mike made it to heaven so he can sit down to the heavenly version of a nice vegetarian meal and mineral water with Adolf, with A.H., and the others whose earthly reputation Mike fought to uphold. With tears in my eyes, I will now go and listen to Mein Bester Kamerad in memory of Michael Collins Piper.
Very nice.
I thought I would read it to just indicate how many people were affected by Mike's work and feel it so very strongly that he's gone. And you know, so what we all notice, I think, it's not just my brilliance or anything, but as soon as somebody is gone for good, then all you see in them is what you liked and all the good that they did. It always takes that when someone can no longer come back and argue with you or say anything that might irritate you or talk, you know, about something. Once they're gone, you think, oh gosh, you know, you realize how valuable they were. But
all right, that's exactly right. And adding to that gentleman's fine statement there, Valhalla is the hall for warriors in the hereafter, and that's where Mike is in my mind, because he was a fine, fine warrior for truth and justice.
And he was also a great fan of Adolf Hitler, and so many of us are, and he, you know, we share that. It gives us a certain outlook on life. And as you, as a lot of people know, because he wrote about it, Mike had a bust of Adolf Hitler in his apartment. And we were talking about, we wondered what happened to it. Who's going
to
get it?
Well, I'm trying to track it down, Carolyn. I called Mark yesterday, and I got to his voicemail. You know, he's probably quite busy, but I asked him about that bust. I said, is that one of the things that Mike brought from D.C. out to Idaho? And or do you know anything about it, and if there's any plans on what's going to be done with it? And I said, I would just like to tell you that I would love to have that, and like if his brother's going to get it and I can buy it from him, or if it's just going anywhere else, I would love to have it. So, you know, I told Mark, I know you're quite busy and this is a rather mundane thing, but if you can, you know, if you've got that up there, I'd like to have that. And so I put in my claim for it. I don't know if it'll come around.
Right. Well, you know, you have to do that. You do have to do that, mm-hmm. because sometimes they say, "Oh, we didn't know anybody wanted that. It just went off in the trash or something." Well, so I was going to say that Mike started his program, his broadcasting on Republic Broadcasting Network on February 1st, 2006. I looked that up and figured that was when I started listening to him, and I called in as a caller a few times. So it was probably in 2007 that I appeared a few times to be a guest on the whole show. And I know the first one I did, I talked about, I had been reading and so impressed by the book Desperate Deception, British Covert Operations in the United States, 1939 and 1944. And I told, I guess, I don't know if I told him about it or whatever, and he said, yeah, we'll call in and we'll do the whole program on that, because he loved that book, and he really got into it. So I talked about that, and afterwards, it went over very well, I think it was after I came on the second time, and I talked about my book, Auschwitz, The Underground Guided Tour, and Mike talked so much in the beginning that he realized he didn't give me much time, since they have all those commercials, you know, at RBN. And it was just an hour show. Right. So he said, come back tomorrow, Carolyn, we'll continue with this. So I came back the next night. And then he said that after that, he said he got so many, I don't mean to be bragging, I'm just trying to tell about the way Mike is.
Honest.
He said he got so many comments about it. He said, Carolyn, and he said it on the air, you're the most popular guest I've ever had.
Wow, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it was. It made me feel good. He said, I've never had anybody that's more popular than you. So I got a very good hearing from Mike, and so did many people. He was a very generous and helpful person in every way, really, wasn't he?
That's right. And you know, when I've written a lot of articles for the Barnes Review, but my biggest and best was the featured article, and I believe it was the September-October issue from 2007, and they titled it True Confessions of a Holocaust Denier, or something like this. And I had written a very extensive article, which they enhanced by adding some photographs and everything. Well, Mike had me on his show to talk about that article, and of course promoted it even more, and we had callers call in and things like this. And so he gave me the same kind of attention and breaks and notice that he gave you. Mm-hmm. And it, of course, it was encouraging and all. And, you know, Mike was saying, hey, Ray, you need to write more for the magazine and such as that. So I did, you know, and I've had a few other articles published there. And I'm still listed as a member on the board of their contributing editors.
I know. How did you get on that board anyway?
They asked me.
When was it that they asked you and put you on there?
Oh, gosh, Carolyn, it was a number of years ago. I think it was maybe 2008.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I just always saw you there.
Yeah, it was a letter from, I can't remember if it was Paul Angel. May have been, but he said, Ray, you're talking about our board of contributing editors, and said, we would love, you know, make you one of them and list you up there, and you could send more articles in to us because we really enjoy them. And would you be willing to let us list your name on that? And I said, absolutely. Go right ahead, and I'll be glad to contribute whenever I can. So that's how that came about. And all, once again, because of good old Mike.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, one thing I want to bring up, Ray, is that people are already saying, people who didn't even know Mike, they just know his name, you know, and hear about it, know something about him, certainly some of his books and so on, but they say, they start talking right away that, oh, he was probably murdered, are we sure he's not murdered?
Yeah.
This bothers me when people do that. I mean, he's only been gone a few days, and right away the first thing these people come up with is, was he murdered by the Mossad? And to me, that's so ridiculous because why don't they at least wait a week or two or a month before they start out with something like that if they want to bring it up? Because there's no information has come out yet. There's no evidence for anything like that. I think it's a big mistake. And I already got into, somebody was saying that and on a discussion group I'm on, and I wrote to him privately saying, why go there? Why say that? I think it's a bad idea.
That's right.
But I just thought I'd bring that up because I think
it's
a mistake.
Well, it's an excellent point. I do too. And like you, I've gotten some of that too from those on my email list that we bandy about, and they're using expressions like strange death and what really went on, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking, hold off on any of that stuff unless an autopsy shows some sort of foreign or body or poison in his, you know, body, whatever. Unless there's some sort of proof that he did not die of natural causes, just keep that stuff.
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be an autopsy anyway, because they've already said it's natural causes. And there's no reason to suspect anything else unless someone would request, you know, someone that is a, represents Mike would request one. But I mean, mm-hmm. that's overdoing it, and it makes this whole movement look stupid.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a loss of credibility.
Yeah. Well, has something gone with Mike Piper's, you know, what does Mike Piper represent that, I don't have an answer for that. I'm just coming up with the question. I haven't had time to really think about it, but you know, does he represent some kind of a time or way of thinking that is passing by, things are changing? We have such a different group of, mm-hmm. what you might call truth tellers today than the kind that he was, which he was very much in touch with the politics and thinking mm-hmm. actually to affect and change the politics. Well, that's American Free Press is that type of an operation tied in with the politics of the United States mm-hmm. and sometimes around the world. He had a vast knowledge of so much of this. And I don't see too many people writing like just combining the kind of things that he combined.
Well, that's a very good point. You know, the way I've given some thought to that myself, Carolyn, and it's like I see a circle of what I prefer to call warriors with various talents and strengths in different areas. And I'm talking people like you. I'm talking about Frederick Tobin, Dr. Robert Forreston, people around the world, and include Mike in that circle, include the Willis Carto for all of his many years, and other what I call patriots for our side in this circle, and we're warriors fighting a battle, and we gather as brethren in a circle, and when someone passes on, you know, it's like all of the knowledge, all of the fighting ability that they had on our behalf is gone and going to be missed. But there, you know, those that are still in the circle, still fight. Carry on the fight. Step into the breach as best you can and go on. We've lost one of our finest. And it's a sad thing, but it happens, and it'll continue to happen, and you just hope there's somebody there to take up the shield and continue the fight. And that's the way I look at how Mike and his place in all of this was. He had much more knowledge than most of us in that circle, and he had a gift for expressing that knowledge, and he's going to be sorely missed.
Oh, he's quite unique. There's nobody like him. I mean, you might not like him. You might say, well, he didn't accomplish everything. But I'm just saying he is totally unique, and there's nobody like him or does the kind of work that he did and has the kind of understanding of things that he had and what Mike brought to all of us and whether there will actually be a legacy that matters and that means something. Or if it will just get lost in the crowd or in the shuffle. What do you think? Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, as far as Mike leaving a legacy, hey, it's in those books. It's in those recordings that are archived and things like this. And that's going to live for a good while. And so, as we both know, he's going to be terribly missed, but his impact was such that it won't be forgotten.
Well, let's hope not. And certainly the one book, Final Judgment, is a major accomplishment that will stand the test of time, that's for sure. It will always remain up there. Mm-hmm. So that's something. Well, we'll wait and see what else comes out. I guess it's kind of early. It took everybody by surprise, and because of the nature of things, there's no information coming out. There's no family.
Right.
He didn't have any more family, I don't think. I don't know. Was his brother still alive?
Well, apparently, Mark Glenn, that's what Mark told me. He said, I received this phone call, and he said it was, Mike's brother, and Mike's brother said, I just wanted to tell you about Mike, and Mark Glenn told me, he said, I thought he was going to tell me that Mike moved into an apartment, there and all, which of course he said, I already knew that, but he said his brother said Mike has died.
So yeah, the police in Coeur d'Alene called Mike's brother. Well, how did they know who Mike's brother was? I thought they would
have
called Mark.
Yeah, I agree. And Mike may have had a list, in his billfold or something, or phone numbers. And naturally, if they see a brother's name. So-and-so Piper, that would be the first one they would call because of being a relative.
Yeah.
So that's the way I kind of think that went down, but...
Okay, well,
anyway.
We wait to see further information, and
we hope
you did a good job, Ray, of doing justice here to our friend Michael Collins Piper.
Well, so did you. So did you. Very much so.
We'll see. But we're sorry. We loved Michael and I probably didn't always treat him like I loved him, but see, there you go. It's always when people are gone, you say, gee, I wish I would have spent a little more time there. But Mike and I, we are on the same wavelength. I know that.
Sure.
And, I'm very, very happy to know that he appreciated me, the way that he did, but I know he appreciated a lot of people. So, Ray, I'm going to let you give any final thoughts that you think we might have left out here.
Well, I think we've covered, our feelings about Michael Collins Piper from A to Z in actuality, and yeah, there are more things we could recall about him and how he was such a positive and a plus influence on those of us of a like mind politically, historically, spiritually, and how valuable a person that Mike Piper was to all of us. And I think that people who listen to this message, a lot of what we said is going to resonate with them in such a positive manner. So I was very pleased that you came up with this idea that we do this, and I was very happy to be a part of this tribute. And there's going to be more tributes to Mike in the days and weeks to come. So I appreciate you allowing me to be a part of it, and appreciate what you had to say. It was fun sharing all this.
Yes, yes. It was nice talking about it. Well, thank you very much, Ray, and thank you, listeners. This is an edition of the Heretics Hour, a special edition, taking place on June 4th, 2015. This is Carolyn Yeager. Thanks for listening to us, ladies and gentlemen. Remember, Mike, so long for now.